Well, good afternoon. I have a wonderful pastor of my church who likes to say the following: my job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. So we'll hopefully do a little bit of that today. My name is Michael Maybach. I'm the moderator for your panel. Thank you for staying to the last panel. We have two excellent speakers for you today on our topic, which is conservatism and the coming economy. Right after me, Dylan Palman will speak. He's with the Acton Institute. He's a research fellow there. He also serves as the managing editor of Journal of Markets and Morality. Probably some of you subscribe to that. He's the author of a book called Foundations of a Free and Virtuous Society, published by Acton in 2017. His research has been published in Faith and Economics, the St. Vladimir's Theological Quarterly, Journal of Reformed Theology, Christian Psychology, interested in that one, and various edited volumes. His essays have been published by the Library of Law and Liberty, Public Discourse, and elsewhere. Our other speaker, our second speaker, is Daniel McCarthy. He's the director of the Robert Novak Journalism Fellowship Program at the Fund for American Studies. I know Roger Rehm is here today. He's also the editor of the journal Modern Age. Some of you subscribe to that, so I suggest both of these journals. His writing has appeared in a wide variety of publications, including the New York Times, which I don't think anybody subscribes to. But it used to be a really good newspaper. The New Criterion, First Things, and Reason. And he's a contributing editor of the magazine The Spectator and was editor of the American Conservative magazine from 2010 to 2016. We have the new editor here earlier today. I'm going to open with some remarks and then we'll go to our two main speakers. As you may know, the great Russell Kirk was born on this day, October 19th, in 1918, 23 days before the war to end all wars, as H.G. Wells wrote, ended. As it happened, I had the great honor of meeting Russell Kirk at my first Philadelphia Society meeting in 1983. What a lucky man I was to have met him and to listen to him, William Buckley, Milton Friedman, Ed Fulner, and many others who have spoken here over the years, to share a meal with them, to ask them questions, to shake their hand. Which reminds us how lucky we are to have this wonderful Philadelphia Society alive and well with our current leadership, Sam Gregg and Lenore Ely. And which also reminds us to bring the next generation of American leaders to our meetings. We're doing more of that, I think you've noticed, and we need to do even more, which is all good. Speaking of luck, in the same year, 1983, I was hired by the four men who founded the Intel Corporation in 1968. My assignment was to serve as the assistant to Intel co-founder Dr. Robert Noyce, a Midwest native like myself. In 1959, Dr. Noyce had invented the integrated circuit, the silicon chip, for which the Silicon Valley is named. As Intel's chairman, Dr. Noyce was the outward-facing executive of our company. My job was to create Intel's government affairs department, mainly to help the U.S. semiconductor industry open the Japanese market, which we eventually did. As Intel's first lobbyist, Dr. Noyce made it clear to me that we were only to speak out on public policies directly affecting our technology, our products, our company, and our employees in their capacity as our employees. Another Intel co-founder, Dr. Andy Grove, put it this way to me: we will only deal with matters of public policy in which we are three questions deep. In other words, if somebody asked you, well, why do you believe that? And why is that? And why is that? And if we couldn't do it, we didn't talk about it. We were to use our commercial power and public stature to advance the policies about which we were deeply knowledgeable. We had no views on the Panama Canal or world hunger at Intel Corporation. It wasn't our job. When I arrived at Intel, everyone had typewriters, in 1983 on their desk. Within 3 years, we all had PCs. It was a robust technology revolution. Just as the machine age had replicated man's arms and legs, so the computer age was beginning to replicate man's logic and his memory. And when all those PCs became connected to the internet, what we once called connected computing, life changed in highly significant ways, with the internet collapsing time and space and leaping over national borders with lightning speed. As a man who has invested 38 years of his life in what I call corporate business diplomacy, I become stunned in the past few years by the approach to public policy by some of our business leaders. Many CEOs today engaged in certain white-hot issues that, back in my Intel days, we would have said, that's just not our business to address. Two brief instances. In 2016, the National Basketball Association pulled their annual All-Star game out of North Carolina because of a state law that required individuals to use the bathrooms corresponding with their biological sex. And today, the NBA is embroiled in the democratic debates in Hong Kong and in China. And this year, the CEO of the Disney company said that his company would stop production in Georgia because the legislature had passed a pro-life piece of legislation. Now, whatever we as private citizens think about these two issues, and surely among us we don't all agree on these two issues, maybe we can at least agree on this. Why are pro basketball teams and the owner of Disneyland taking highly visible public stands on bathrooms and abortions? Which leads us to the larger question, why does virtually every part of our lives today seem to have become so political? Briefly, I believe our friend Alexis de Tocqueville offers insights that help answer this question. He told us that as the world moved from the age of aristocracy to the age of equality, men and women moved from equality in servitude to equality of opportunity. And in what he called the Great Change, God collapsed into man, man collapsed into himself. He coined the term individualism when he wrote about that. For the first time, men looked around and found their traditional places in life were gone. They also noticed that while they remained unequal among others, they could now do something about it. Whereas the fixity of the age of aristocracy led men to feel that they could ameliorate but never change the conditions in which life had placed them. In this new democratic age, energized by the Enlightenment and the age of science, men came to believe in both science and the regulatory state, tools of man-made progress. The ills of society could now be solved by men and their governments, and thus was born the idea of progress, social justice, and the quest for equality. In the machine age, man replicated his arms and legs. In the computer age, man has replicated his logic and memory. Has this now led to the notion that man can recreate his own nature and to do so to advance this idea of equality? I believe this is what has happened. Society itself has now become a project, and the left has called upon all people in all stations of life, in academia, in news media, certainly the Academy Awards, Hollywood, business, nonprofits, to improve our society at every moment, at every turn, and to have an opinion about all things that would improve our society. Tocqueville told us that if men were forced to choose between freedom and equality, they would choose equality. The Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and I love this fact, has but one sentence from the Old Testament, from Leviticus 25:10. It reads, the Liberty Bell reads, proclaim liberty throughout the land and unto all the inhabitants thereof. Our topic today is conservatism and the coming economy. I have no doubt that the coming economy will bring us ever more dazzling technological wonders. What is not as clear is whether the coming economy will have enough of Russell Kirk's ideas of conservatism to keep us free against these forces of progress. With that, Ellen?